Welcome back, Red Ice members. We are talking with Russ Baker about the Family of Secrets. This is all about the Bush family dynasty. We've been primarily talking about Poppy Bush, George Herbert Walker Bush, and now we're going to progress forward, as it were, talk a little bit more about W, the son, George W. Bush. And I guess the most obvious kind of question here in regards to the background that we talked about with Poppy, Russ, is to ask you a little bit about the agenda of W. Do you feel that he pretty much has carried on the agenda of Poppy, or has he been running a totally different game, so to speak, and did he do his own thing, or is this dynasty much like the, you know, European dynasties in that sense, in regards to the one agenda seems to be passing through the generations, if you know what I mean?
I've thought long and hard about that, and it's not an easy question to answer, but it is a very good question. I think that the temperament of the two men, George H.W. Poppy Bush and George W. Bush, are very different. But I think that they essentially see themselves as advancing the same interest and the same worldview. And that is a worldview in which the only way that, in their mind, civilization can proceed is for a select few, an elite that they see as better qualified, more refined, better educated somehow, tough-minded, that these people are the ones who really ought to make the decisions. And if you study your political philosophy, of course, that notion has existed throughout time. And so I think that George W. Bush understands, as his father does, that history is shaped not so much by the great men that we focus on, but on these forces behind the scenes, and that he was very enthusiastic about continuing this. There certainly were differences of style, and I think this came to their perceptions of what was possible. The father invaded Iraq. The son invaded Iraq. The father served the interests of corporations and oilmen, and the son did. They both were very much saw government as an opportunity to take the regulation off of their friends' businesses and use it instead to advance those friends' interests. Across the board, you see a commonality of values, and I hope in this hour we can talk about in some detail where the indications that, in fact, George W. Bush was really continuing what his father did, albeit in certain ways that manifested themselves differently.
Absolutely, and I guess, again, we can kind of just recap that story that you mentioned, that, George, or W, rather, he would never have gotten into office unless it was for his dad, right? That he primarily was not fit for the job, so to speak, but he was kind of riding on the wave of his dad. Do you think that's correct?
Absolutely, but not just that. I mean, the son was a key player in helping orchestrate his father's political success, and the father, very much behind the scenes, was a key force in orchestrating the son's rise to power. And in fact, of course, if you look, you see the same people involved. If we flip back to the father, earlier I was talking about my discovery, which certainly astonished me, that there was a whole secret history behind Watergate and the removal of Richard Nixon. That removal brought Gerald Ford to power. Gerald Ford, a connection back to the JFK assassination, because Gerald Ford was on the Warren Commission and had slightly altered the report in such a way that advanced the single bullet theory. Gerald Ford then, there was what is referred to as the Halloween Massacre, where Gerald Ford swung far to the right, away from what Nixon was doing, and there was we see the promotions of two men who themselves would later come on to be associated with that rightist policy, Donald Rumsfeld and Dick Cheney. Now, many people don't know that they were in the White House. One was chief of staff and one was defense secretary for Gerald Ford. And they were basically in power when Poppy Bush, who was off as envoy to China, was brought back to the United States and installed as CIA director. So you see this same circle that resurfaces 30 years later under the sun, the same people. Rumsfeld, Cheney, yes. Colin Powell was involved with the father, involved with the son. A lot of these same people. You see Robert Gates. Robert Gates was a lifelong CIA officer who, under Poppy Bush, served as a head of the CIA. And then under George W. Bush, he was brought back in as defense secretary to take over for Rumsfeld. And very interestingly, by the way, in the interim years, Robert Gates was not only put on the boards of a number of companies connected to the oil industry, but he was made the head of the university and library where the papers of Poppy Bush are kept. And I spent quite a bit of time doing research there, and I was struck by how they had sanitized these records. They had removed so many things that were essential in connecting the dots to find out about Poppy Bush's true history.
That's
so
very
this
interesting.
Continuity is there, absolutely.
Yeah, absolutely. And what about this idea that W was a kind of an outspoken Christian talking to God, whatnot? Do you think that that's a card that the administration played at that time to kind of get away with certain things, to take it to a, I don't know, kind of an ideological or a theological level instead of a political level?
I didn't know what to make of that, but as I began studying George W. Bush, I discovered all of these things about him that are not known, and I began to say, boy, you know, he's not really the person we think he is. You know, some of the surface things, yes, bumbling, inarticulate, short attention span, arrogant, somewhat reckless, true. But there was a whole other history to him that I discovered, and this pertains to the issue you raise about how he was characterized in terms of religious beliefs, but it pertains to actually his whole life. And I began discovering, and so what I do in Family of Secrets is in the second half of the book, I start following George W., and we see that he's involved in all sorts of things that have never come out before. That we could talk a little later about his military service, which is fascinating. But
yes.
Also, right after the military, he starts working and being involved with these companies that I discover all have the hallmarks of being connected to money laundering, intelligence operations, foreign operations, very, very peculiar companies that continue to exist despite the fact they don't make any money generally for the shareholders. So I began to see that he, like his father, was enmeshed in this secretive apparatus and creating cover stories. And so as we watch him progressing, we see him getting into politics, and we see them creating this story that he is very different from the father, that he's this guy who had lived a kind of a reckless younger life, a big drinker and what have you, but that he had then found the Lord and changed his ways. And it looks like he did stop drinking, but there's no evidence, actually, that he ever became a deeply religious man. In fact, again, trying to stay with the facts, in Family of Secrets, I have a whole chapter on the religious, so-called religious conversion, and I actually document that prior to the year in which he claims he had a walk on the beach with a well-known minister and suddenly saw the light and changed his life, that prior to that, there was an advisor to the Bush family counseling them that they urgently needed to get religion, that their watered-down, weak form of Christianity, their sort of Episcopalianism, would not fly with this huge and rapidly growing voter bloc known as the evangelicals. Jimmy Carter, a Democrat, had been elected with a lot of evangelical votes, and he was a long-time and well-known born-again Christian. Ronald Reagan, who was not religious, nevertheless was a great actor, and he embraced this, and he got their votes. And then Poppy Bush, who had lost to Reagan in the primaries in 1980, was getting advice from this man, this consultant, who was involved with evangelicals, and he said, "You must embrace this." And I established that prior to George W. Bush himself embracing it, they were receiving memos from this man telling them that they needed to do exactly that. And this man, who I interview extensively, who provided me with memos, you can see that this was essentially a very, very careful calculation to win over these tens of millions of people, and they did. And in fact, had they not done that, George W. Bush would have lost in 2000, and of course would have lost for re-election in 2004. He would have never been president of the United States.
Hmm. That's interesting. So it's all a show in one sense then. What about the involvement of, well, I guess we can start a little bit with his, you know, the beginning of his period in 2001, World Trade Center going down, all these stories about the Bin Ladens having relationship with the Bushes and so forth. Is that anything that you go into in your book?
What I go into extensively is the secret pipeline between involving the Bushes and the Saudis. And this goes back to the early 1970s. This is the background, if you will, for the very close relationship that leads George W. Bush's administration to suspend the no-fly rule so that they can get all of these members of the Bin Laden family and people associated with the royal family quickly out of the United States. This is the background. Whatever anybody thinks about what happened on 9/11, this much is clear. There was a secret history. This goes back to the early 1970s, and what we see is the United States realizing or perceiving that, of course, oil is absolutely the lifeblood of both the industrial and the military engines of this country. That absolutely an uninterrupted flow of oil was essential. We saw with the 1973 Yom Kippur War and the estrangement of the United States from the Arab countries, the oil embargo by the oil producers, that a determination was made that this would never happen again. And we see a very, very secretive outreach to the Saudis in which what is created is this, what you might call a sort of a shotgun marriage in which the United States and the Saudis become very, very close. And the Saudi royal family is basically told, we know that you're always in danger of being overthrown, and we're going to help you stay in power. We're going to create countervailing forces in your country, other security forces than the military, which is always at risk of overthrowing you. We're going to train you. We're going to provide intelligence information to you. We will keep you in power. In return, you will provide an uninterrupted supply of petroleum, and also you will channel the petrodollars to the U.S. economy, and more specifically, and this is what I really focus on in these chapters in Family of Secrets, this money flows into Houston, and it flows into an apparatus run by a fellow who was in the National Guard with George W. Bush, a close friend of his, who is basically put in charge of this sort of secret relationship and this money from one member of the Bin Laden family and one member of another very powerful Saudi family starts coming into Houston, being put into all of these banks and airports and other apparatuses, which in turn, some of the money flows to the friends of the Bushes, a vast amount of money, and some of it flows offshore and apparently is used to finance unauthorized covert operations that, again, advance the interests of these same powerful corporations and so on that were concerned about the Sandinistas in Nicaragua, concerned about the revolutions in El Salvador and Guatemala. And so it's a very, very complicated web that they create. But this relationship really begins in earnest in the 1970s. Poppy Bush appears to be at the heart of the thing, running the whole thing, ratcheting it up when he becomes CIA director in 1976, continuing to run it from outside the government when Jimmy Carter becomes president and pushes Poppy out. Poppy Bush flies to Plains, Georgia, to talk to President-elect Jimmy Carter and to beg him to leave him in as CIA director. Carter says no. And in fact, Carter is so concerned about the threat of some of these activities to the viability of the American democracy that he puts his own man in as the head of the CIA, who begins dismantling the covert operations apparatus, firing many of these people, and they all then become the impetus for Poppy Bush's first campaign for the presidency. So I guess what I'm emphasizing here, Henrik, is that there's sort of a seamless and continuous hidden narrative in which George H.W. Bush, George W. Bush are both being groomed and brought to the top and then pursuing the interests of these private outfits, not of necessarily of the ordinary American. And this is very much the story with the Saudis. The Saudis are elites living fabulously on the backs of people living much more modestly, taking, what is the basis for the Saudis to siphon off so much of the oil wealth for themselves. I mean, obviously, that's not the basis of a democracy or equity. And it's the same thing with the Bushes and their wealthy friends.
Hmm. Well, it's a bit of a side note, I guess, in that regard. But do you think that's a threat, so to speak, to the United States continuing to this day?
I think that we're beginning to see that many of these policies that were presented as in the interests of the American people, as the interests of national security and so on, were in many ways in the interests of these elites. And we're seeing the consequences of that. The United States economy, not just for the reasons of the recent financial disasters, but over a long period of decline, has been confronted by this outsized military budget, by the diversion of resources into the hands of the few. You live in Sweden, a society with a much more equitable distribution of income. The United States has seen a growing gap between the richest, very small group of people and everybody else. It has gotten worse and worse and worse. Mm. And so, yes, I mean, I think these policies have benefited them to the detriment of ordinary Americans. And I think people are just beginning to wake up. We're in an exciting period now where, thanks to shows like yours and the internet, we can really begin discussing these things.
Yes.
And perhaps eventually arm the public, you know, to take back their countries.
Couldn't agree more with you, Russ. So if we go back to the Iraq war again and the invasion of Iraq and discuss a little bit more about the possibilities of what the reasons for that were. You mentioned oil, you mentioned money, of course, and there's always, as you said previously, more often more reasons than one to do something. But is there anything else you can mention in regards to the Iraq war, why there was an interest to go into this region at this point in time?
Yes. And one thing I want to say is I am revealing a number of the exclusives, shall we say, from my book, Family of Secrets, to your listeners. But if they think that what they're hearing here is everything in the book, it just doesn't even begin to scratch the surface. Some of the people who have endorsed the book, including Gore Vidal and other eminent people, have said that they were just staggered by what was in it, that they found revelations on every page, even in every paragraph. And so we can only just begin to sort of probe these things. But
yes,
with regard to Iraq, where I devote a number of chapters, one very interesting and I think salient aspect is that I interviewed a man named Mickey Herskowitz, who was a Texas journalist, had a very good relationship with the Bush family, with Poppy Bush, and he wrote books, what they call ghost-written biographies, for a host of well-known figures. And in 1999, when George W. Bush, when W. was running for president, Mickey had approached him and his campaign to say, hey, what about a book? Why don't we do a book? I'll write the book. I'll talk to George W. We'll have a book that can come out during the election and, you know, be beneficial to the campaign. And Mickey worked on the book. He was eventually removed from the project, and stories were put out as to why, but they replaced him, and they put a woman named Karen Hughes, who was one of the spinners of W's New Image. They put her on to finish the book. The book came out. I always wondered, why was Mickey Herskowitz removed from the project and what was going on? And in 2004, I managed to interview him. This was in the fall, in the final month or so of the battle, very close battle between George W. Bush and John Kerry. And I managed to get Mickey to talk to me. He had never talked to any journalists about this. And I sat down with him for lunch, and I tape recorded it. And I asked him what was going on and what was that like to work with him. And Mickey began to tell me what it was like. And he, among other things, he explained that that he had asked George W. Bush for the book. He said to him, okay, now tell me some things about your past and your life that we can include here. And George W. Bush didn't want to do that. And he felt that he had not accomplished enough in his life up to this moment to focus on that in a book. And, of course, that itself is astounding. Here's a man who was about to be elected president of the United States. He did not feel that he had any accomplishments to speak of. Now, he then said, what else can we put in the book? So Mickey said, well, we can also focus on your ambitions, what you hope to achieve as president. And again, George W. Bush made the remarkable statement that he, you know, he seemed to have trouble thinking of anything, and he referred Mickey to Karl Rove, the spinmeister of Bush's image.
Right.
And Mickey became sort of frustrated because he wanted to get some things directly, so to speak, from the horse's mouth. So he said, "Well, let's try to think of some things that are you know, uppermost in your mind." At which point, Bush, in an unguarded moment, said to him, "Well, I'll tell you one thing I'm going to do, sure as can be." He said, "My father invaded Iraq, and he stopped. He said, I'm not going to stop. If I've got a reason to invade Iraq, I'm going to do it. I'm going to go all the way. I'm going to knock Saddam Hussein out." And he Herskowitz asked him what his objective was, and he said, "You know, I've been told by our advisors that you could not have a successful presidency unless you're seen as commander-in-chief, unless you're seen as the head of the military, unless you successfully launch and win a small war."
Hmm.
And this is the revelation, Henrik, that George W. Bush in his own mind felt that one could go in to Iraq, remove Saddam Hussein pretty easily, and mop it all up and be a hero, certainly to the people of the United States, and that by doing this you would consolidate your power, it would be very difficult for the opposition to stop you, and you would be able to pass your entire political agenda.
Oh my God. How about that, huh? So, I mean, how the heck did he get in a second term in regards to that? I mean, there have been talks about manipulation of the numbers, the black box voting machines, all this stuff. Anything that you go into in your book?
Yes. Again, I've got at least a chapter, and I think several chapters, that address the uses of propaganda, the manipulation of the traditional media, and their ability to intimidate. This is all comes out of this intelligence construct that we've been discussing. Central Intelligence Agency, like all intelligence organizations, devotes a tremendous amount of effort to psychological manipulation. And they've studied how you influence people through advertising and publicity and more covert means, disinformation, deception, and what have you. And I think that what George W. Bush essentially was, he was a walking, talking disinformation operation, that the people working with him were basically misleading the public, misleading the media in almost every respect. And so what Family of Secrets is about is that, as one friend of mine said, he said, "You know, what your book should be called is Everything You Know is Wrong." And
right.
So he wasn't really born again. He wasn't somebody who had finished his military service. He was not estranged from his father. He was not any of these things. And so what we see with the 2004 election was that they knew that John Kerry was a threat, because whereas what they were afraid of was that the media might really dig into George W. Bush's military service career and discover that he had just skipped out in the middle of a war. And if that was discovered, if that was established, if that became the national conversation in the media, he would lose, because George W. Bush's political base was overwhelmingly people who are, if you want to say, sympathetic to the military, fascinated with wars. A large percentage of war veterans backed him. A lot of people who identify themselves as what they call themselves patriots, who consider it often necessary to use the military. And if those people were to learn that this man who had started an unnecessary war that wreaked havoc in the United States, in Iraq, and really throughout the world, and helped unleash this unending jihad, if you will, that this man himself had just decided not to do the final 2 years of his service, he would have lost overwhelmingly. And so they had to hide this. And in Family of Secrets, they describe how they hid it, how they cowed the media. There's a story where, you may know this story, Dan Rather, the anchor of the CBS Evening News and correspondent for a program called 60 Minutes, he breaks a story in the fall with new documents establishing evidence that George W. Bush did not finish his military service, and it backfires. It explodes in Dan Rather's face, and people come forward to say those documents are fake. And so the whole focus of the public shifts from, did George W. Bush do his military service, and is he a hypocrite, to, is the media operating on falsehoods? And so this is a classic disinformation campaign, and we see the media unwilling to confront this. And by the time time I go to major news organizations in October of 2004 with my taped interviews with Mickey Herskowitz about the real reason George W. Bush launched the invasion of Iraq, I could not get them to publish it. Wow. They all said, we know you, we love your work, we know that you're the credibility of what we do, what you do, but frankly, after the Dan Rather affair, it's too explosive. Too difficult to do this kind of story.
That's interesting because, again, I mean, as I mentioned at the beginning of the program, you have written for The New Yorker, Vanity Fair, The Nation, New York Times, Washington Post, and so forth. Do you think that this is primarily done through the editors of these magazines? How do you think that the agenda is being run throughout all of these major media outlets, Russ?
It's very complicated. I mean, I think most journalists of all stripes, whoever they work for, are conscientious people. I have friends in all media in this country and around the world, and I believe most journalists, wherever they are quite sincere in trying to get to the truth. But the reality is, the more you write about, the more you talk about powerful elites and people who shape events, you begin to anger these powerful elites. And you have to remember that most of the media in the United States, as in Italy, where a lot of it is owned by Berlusconi and so forth, these are owned by very rich people who have very rich friends, and they have their own interests. Also, many of the people and families that have traditionally, and corporations that have traditionally owned these news outlets also own other companies. NBC historically was a major defense contractor. So was CBS. They also have other interests. They're going before the federal government to obtain licenses for broadcasting and what have you. And so they have a lot of different issues that are very different than the issues of their own journalists. But the journalists themselves understand that there are things you can write about and there are things you cannot write about, that you have to bend over backwards to seem unbiased to the extent where you have to treat both sides to everything almost equally, even if you know that perhaps in certain instances one side basically has the public interest in mind and one side is very much cynical. This is something that you can't do. And so the world has become divided between the so-called reputable mainstream commercial media outlets and the opinion media, which is these websites that make allegations which are interesting but which I find to be highly questionable. I'm critical of the mainstream media, I'm also critical of many, many websites that traffic in speculation, gossip, what people call conspiracy theory, that are not carefully vetted. And this is why I created whowhatwhy.com. This is why we're asking the public to make donations so that we, unbeholden to any kind of special interests or ideology, can really dig for the answers and document them so that people throughout the world, irrespective of their background or their philosophy, can assess this information and can decide for themselves what the heck is really going on.
Absolutely. And do you think that the media is changing in that regard? Do you think that the time for these old media outlets is over in that regard, or still do you feel that they still will remain as giants, so to speak, in guiding policy and you know, getting into the minds of the people, as it were?
Well, first of all, I want to say that I think it's very important that the old media survive in some form. Clearly, with the Internet revolution and the collapse of the financial fortunes of these old line media companies, they're going to have to reconstitute themselves. But I am a big advocate of the, if you want to say, the American school of journalism, which is this notion that you go into every story you do not taking sides. The only side you take is the side of the truth, the side of, if you want to say, the public, the broader public interest, which is what is good for society, what is good for everybody, is to get the truth out, to let the chips fall where they may. I think that the United States does have, in many respects, a very high standard of journalism from these organizations. I still think that if you have to read one thing, the New York Times is a comprehensive reporting effort by very smart, diligent people who are doing the best that they can within those limitations. So I don't want to see those organizations collapse. But I do think the rise of the Internet, where millions of voices can be heard, is a good thing. I think we need that criticism. I think we need that diversity of opinion. We need the independent journalists, such as myself, to find new platforms. I always faced limitations, Henrik, in trying get my work into those mainstream entities. And so the rise of sites like whowhatwhy.com, I think this is all good. But I want to differentiate between journalism that is based on research and opinion. Because the vast majority of sites on the Internet that call themselves journalism, that say that they do investigative journalism, they don't. Those are people who have an agenda, and they're advancing it through basically opinion. And so we need that. We need opinion.
Yeah.
We need old-fashioned classical journalism, and we need everything in between. But we need to know the difference.
Absolutely. I think that's a very good way of looking at it. And I think it's also up to the, how should I put it, the consumer, so to speak, of the information or of the news to make that kind of choice, so to speak, that, okay, is this something that I do want to continue supporting in regards to if they buy the papers or, subscribe to the news magazines or what have you. It needs to be the reader, the viewer, and the whatnot needs to be informed and kind of take their own responsibility as well. I feel that they shouldn't hand that over just because it's a big name in regards to a paper or whatnot. So would you agree with that?
I think that's very, very well said. For too long, individuals have passed the buck. They've said, well, what can I do? You know, the system's corrupt. It is the way it is. I'm just going to focus on my own little existence, and I'm not going to pay any attention. I'm not going to care. We don't live in those times anymore. People can make a difference. You begin by being an intelligent consumer, by devoting the time to studying what's out there, reading a range of different kinds of things. And also, very, very important, is to get involved. And this is what whowhatwhy.com is about. Not just that we hope that people will make these sort of modest monthly donations to support it, but also that people will get involved in sending us things that they read somewhere that they think are interesting, they should bring to our attention, suggestions of stories to pursue, if they have inside information they want to share with us, and also just spreading the word. This is very, very important. With whowhatwhy.com and with Family of Secrets, my book, these things are growing by word of mouth, and I have seen how a handful of what I would call citizen activists, and not just in the United States, but we have friends in Europe, South America, Africa, everywhere, who have taken it upon themselves to go on the Internet to post things and to say to other people, hey, you don't know about this book, you don't know about this site, I recommend these things, get involved. And they multiply their influence. Just one person sitting at their computer diligently reading and then going out and posting informed comments, it spreads.
Yes.
And they influence other people. And we really begin to democratize the whole process.
Absolutely. Very, very good way of looking at it, I think. And I do want to backtrack a little bit here and talk about, I have a few more things I want to ask you in regards to W, as it were, and the election of 2004. We have John Kerry, of course. The Skull and Bones issue, anything that you dived into at all in Family of Secrets?
I do talk somewhat about Skull and Bones and a little bit about some of the other secretive organization, membership organizations. There are a number of books that focus specifically on Skull and Bones, and so I'm more interested in just sort of touching on it as it relates to this larger notion of a kind of a sense of the idea that elites should rule, that the public doesn't need information, that they ought to leave it to these other people who know best. That's really what I think these organizations are about. I don't know, ultimately, the full extent of groups like Skull and Bones, but I can tell you this. The people who join these groups do so because they want to be part of elites. They want to get the benefits of being in a small, select group of people who are extremely well-connected. And so we see them getting each other jobs. We see a lot of them getting high positions in the media. We see them entering the early American intelligence apparatus, the extent to which it permeated that, the industrial complex. And we see the intermarriage. We see the business associations between them. And so the way that I think outfits like Skull and Bones are dangerous, and by the way, some presidents, and I believe FDR was one, I think John F. Kennedy was one, where they said that leaders should not be members of organizations that hold secrets and then have confidential oaths of loyalty.
Yeah.
These are dangerous for democracy because we need to know who our leaders are, and we need And so Skull and Bones and a lot of these people that I studied in Family of Secrets appear to be members of these very large fraternal organizations like the Masons and the Scottish Rite Temple and so forth. You know, and people may think those are benign. They may think they're silly. They may think they're good. They may think they're dangerous. They may think they're charitable. Whatever they are, they also have a major dose of secrecy and of so-called brotherhood behind the scenes. And so these things are something we need to discuss, whether they're good for, you know, the advancement, if you will, of civilization in general. You know, I have my doubts.
You do, yeah. I do too. And, you know, before we skip that part entirely, you mentioned a little bit about, you know, whatever people might think of 9/11 and so forth. I mean, this is a huge step or a huge event in American and even world history in that regard. And W was in office when this happened. Do you go into 9/11, anything in your book, or have you chosen to leave that out because it's such a huge subject? How did you go about that?
I do point out something that is significant, that the neocons, who were not George W. Bush but were part of the administration, a major part of the administration, that they certainly had talked in the 1990s about the benefits of invading Iraq, that certain interests had seen it as an opportunity to project military, U.S. military and colonial power, that some had seen it for the enormous benefits of seizing the second largest supply of oil in the world, that some had had other reasons for that, and that the Project for the New American Century, a group that influenced George W. Bush, had stated that while there were certainly benefits to going in and removing Saddam Hussein, that the public would never go along with it, short of another Pearl Harbor. Now, whether that statement, which was made in public documents of the organization, relates to anything more than an acknowledgement of the difficulties, or whether it relates to something more serious or more heinous, I cannot say. I will tell you this. Like almost everything that has happened significant in history, there are untold stories. There are untold stories about 9/11. There are lots of discrepancies, as simple as the conflicting statements that Dick Cheney himself made as to where he was that morning and what he was doing.
Yeah.
There are lots of interesting things to examine. There are engineering issues. There are issues on the backgrounds of the hijackers. There are so many different things that can be examined. I, at this point, would not conclude anything except to say that my mind is open. I would also say that journalists ought to be willing to look into anything, and I am. I would be willing to examine, without any prejudice, any information. But I'll tell you this, one of my frustrations is that this 9/11 truth movement that is so vocal, they don't put up the funds. I get all these emails every single day telling me, why don't you look into this? Well, you know, why don't people step up and support independent journalism, not just to look into that, but to look into everything? Why don't people why aren't people willing to fund this kind of thing? Because the only way you're going to have a free and independent media that looks into 9/11, the true relationship with the Saudis, the real story behind Iraq, behind all of these things, is for the public, as they do in other countries, to finance journalism and to let professional trained journalists who don't have an agenda look into everything and go wherever the facts go.
Yeah, absolutely, and in that regard, I think that the people united in that regard, in that sense, could create a more powerful media than anything we see today in the world in regards to these other big media corporations. And if we got together, as it were, on that note, it could be a huge, powerful and important asset in that fight, so to speak. The difficulty, I guess, and the challenge in that is to prevent even that from being, you know, if something grows too big, let me put it that way, it's always a danger of that becoming, influenced and taken over in one regard. Is that something that that worries you in that regard, especially when you have been researching the influences of the CIA, of the FBI, and all these other agencies, and how they seem to take over organizations. Is that something that worries you?
There's always a danger of that, but I mean, I do think that when a handful of skilled, experienced journalists with a really solid reputation are given funding by a mass base, not by one foundation or company, but by a mass base of donors, they don't feel beholden to anybody. And if they're good at what they do and they start asking questions, of course there will be efforts to subvert the inquiry. But, you know, as I showed with Family of Secrets, I was able to go back and look at the Kennedy assassination, something I always assumed Lee Harvey Oswald acted alone. Mm-hmm. That's all that was. I had never really paid a lot of attention to it. Watergate, I just accepted that it was that the heroes were Woodward and Bernstein, that they got to the bottom of the true story. Mm-hmm. And then I looked at them, and I looked at them because I found, if you will, Bush fingerprints there, and I wanted to know more, and I was writing a book about the Bushes. And what I discovered, I shocked myself, and I shocked my friends, and I shocked a lot of people. I would say that certainly if I looked at 9/11, and if other people that I think are the kind of people that ought to be working on this thing worked with me on it together or separately, if we had the resources, I think we would go a long way to at least clearing up the anomalies, the mysteries, and the questions that people have.
Absolutely. I have a few more things here, Russ, before we begin to round things up here for this time. I think you write a little bit about Hillary Clinton's connection to the Bush family as well, don't you?
Yes, so this is something that I wrote about for the website whowhatwhy.com, and then I include, a bit of it in the book, although there's much more to be found on the site in the right-hand column there. I was intrigued to discover, one of the things I do in Family of Secrets is I go back and I look at a very interesting company called Harkin Energy. This company basically made it possible for George W. Bush to accrue his own fortune, to become comfortable and to be able to pursue a political career. And this company has all the earmarks of being some kind of intelligence operation. There's all of these money coming in from offshore, from Saudis, money tied to the dictatorship of Ferdinand Marcos and the South African apartheid regime and the Iranian dictator, the Shah. And as I look at this, there's also money coming in from the endowment of Harvard University, which is now reeling from bad investments. And so as I look at this, I find a man running the company who's a very curious individual. And again, we don't have time here, but in Family of Secrets, they can read this whole long backstory of him and his father and their seeming synchronicities, if you will, with intelligence. And then I discover that when Hillary Clinton starts running for president, the same man resurfaces with a business partner who has ties back to the Shah of Iran. And these same guys now are involved. First they were involved with George W. Bush. Now they're involved with the Democrats. They're involved with Hillary Clinton. And we see this Iranian man, the business partner of the Harkin fellow, being identified as Hillary Clinton's, one of her key
mentors,
foreign affairs advisors. And I think, well, this is astonishing.
Yeah.
And so, yes, you see this kind of continuity of these murky corporate and financial interests with their ties to ancien regimes and intelligence and military contracting resurfacing again and again on both sides of the aisle. And certainly we need to talk about these things. We need to say, what does this mean? And how viable is the two-party system in the era, so-called reform era, of Barack Obama?
Absolutely, exactly. And that's one of my final questions here for you in regards to the aftermath here, so to speak, of the Bush years and now Obama coming in. Is there any difference in that regard? And I don't see it, considering the current administration and the number of people who have been involved in Bush previously. What do you see here, Russ? Where is it going?
There are very big differences. The differences that you see, and I think this is true to some extent just between the Republicans and Democrats, you see big changes on the domestic level. I think you're going to see different kinds of people on the Supreme Court to some extent, particularly on social issues and on constitutional issues. You do see much more sympathy for the consumer in relation to the powers of the banks and the credit card companies and so on. You do see it in a number of areas, but where you don't see it is in a lot of big picture issues that relate to the military budget, the vast, sprawling defense contracting establishment with relation to the powers, the unlimited and really unregulated powers of the elites within the intelligence apparatus. You don't really see it with regard to the very wealthy, with regard to the titans behind finance in America, which FDR said back in 1933. He wrote a letter and he said, "You and I both know that the real powers in America are in the great financial centers." I think that's still true. I think Barack Obama knows it. He received almost half of his money came from the internet, and the other half came from hedge funds and other powerful interests. There are very, very serious limits. Whatever you may think of him, and he's obviously a gifted politician, a very intelligent and capable individual, much more so than George W. Bush, but he's very limited. He's hemmed in on what he could do if he wanted to get elected president, and what he can do if he wants to stay president and serve out 4 and maybe 8 years without excessively angering these powerful forces. There are severe limits to the debate. It's a very, very narrow debate. And I think that speaks very gravely for our ability to ever expand democracy into something that is meaningful. So I think we need to have this discussion. We need to find out, what do the people who work with Barack Obama really think about these kinds of revelations? Are they aware of these subterranean power struggles that go on? And how are they responding to that? And what will they do? And that is a conversation I hope Family of Secrets has helped launch. I hope that perhaps another book I do helps contribute to that. I hope that groups like whowhatwhy.com, with the public going and making small monthly donations, that we can continue this dialogue and we can keep the pressure on whoever is in power in the United States. And eventually, I'd like to report about governments in Sweden and in England and in everywhere, Iran, all over the world, and create a kind of a growing democracy movement so we can increase accountability and we can increase transparency for the good of everybody.
I agree with you. And the further down the road we go, so to speak, the more of these governments seem to be joining together as well. Now we have the EU. Sweden, for instance, is leaving their power is in the hands of someone else, so to speak, and everything is becoming centralized and nothing is on a local level anymore, which makes it even more important in that regard. So I totally agree with you there, Russ. Well, with that, I definitely want to thank you for your time today. Russ, I really enjoyed our conversation. Some really, really interesting perspectives that we've talked about here from you. Please go ahead and mention your websites again so people know where to go to find out more information about you, your book, and your other organization.
Sure. Again, the book is called Family of Secrets. There are three words. The website is familyofsecrets.com. The full title of the book is Family of Secrets, The Bush Dynasty, The Powerful Forces That Put It in the White House, and What Their Influence Means for America. The book can be found in bookstores in the United States, also can be ordered throughout the world online from various sites. There's a site for independent bookstores. There's BarnesandNoble.com. There's Amazon.com. There are other sites where you can also order. There are some nonprofit groups that sell the book. If people Google it, they will find it. We also have WhoWhatWhy.com. WhoWhatWhy. WhoWhatWhy.com. Our nonprofit for investigative journalism, where we invite people to visit, get involved, perhaps, if you like, back us so that we can do much more of this kind of reporting in the future.
WhoWhatWhy.com, familyofsecrets.com. Thank you very much for your time, Russ. Keep up the great work.
Well, thank you, and you keep up the great work too, Henry.
This is Red Eyes Radio. We hope you've enjoyed this program with Russ Baker. My thanks to Fredrik and Elizabeth. Take good care and don't forget to enjoy the summer if you're in the Northern Hemisphere. Keep your eyes on redicecreations.com. We'll be back soon with more radio, videos, and webcasts.